You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Navy has chosen Marinette to build its latest warship. We'll talk to Congressional Representative Mike Gallagher about the news and what it could mean for the community. Now, the slow reopening of the state's economy is underway, with retailers and drive-in movie theaters allowed to reopen as of today with some limitations. That comes from an executive order released this afternoon by Governor Tony Evers. And the rest of the state's businesses are likely to follow suit soonish, with Evers' stay-at-home order set to expire in a little over 2 weeks on May 26th. A legal challenge from state Republicans could end the order before that. So how will day-to-day business look different when that happens, and how can businesses protect their employees and their customers? Missy Hughes is the CEO and secretary of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. The agency is out with new safety guidelines for businesses here in the state. Secretary Hughes, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, before we get into these guidelines, I know this announcement today about retailers came from another department, but can you tell us a little bit about what changes here?
Yeah, so under the original Safer at Home order, we had essential versus non-essential businesses. And although a large number of businesses remained open in the state, grocery and gas stations and building supplies and home supplies, we did have a number of solely retail stores remain closed over the course of the last 6 weeks or so. And this order in particular is a dialing of the ability of these retailers to open with five or less customers at a time. So we had allowed curbside delivery and curbside pickup, and now we're allowing those small retailers to open with five customers or less at a time.
With these new guidelines, before we get into specifics, where did you go to come up with the recommendations for this wide variety of businesses here in the state?
You know, this is really based on a risk analysis. And as we look at places where you can allow for good social distancing, you can keep track of high touch areas, you can clean after folks have been in and out, we felt that the small retail was really an opportunity to allow for some more economic activity along Main Street in all our communities, whether urban or rural. And so it was really a risk analysis.
Now, for the new guidelines that WEDC unveiled, I know a restaurant is going to be really different from an office place. But that said, are there some general guidelines that any business should be thinking about as it reopens?
Yeah, thank you. So last week, at the very end of last week, we were able to stand up on our website a series of guidelines and resources for businesses to consider as they get ready to reopen. And the real point of it is exactly what you're saying, is that every business is different. And so we were able to look at lots of different protocols and guidelines that have been issued by all sorts of different industries, whether it's the restaurant industry or the hotel and lodging industry. But it's developed by industry, and it's thought about practically from the focus of industry. And we took those and looked at them and worked with DHS, and now we've made them applicable for Wisconsin businesses. So if you're a Wisconsin cafe, you own a cafe in a small town in Wisconsin, and you're thinking about, okay, how do I get ready to reopen? Because all things being equal, you know, our trend lines are good. We're going to head towards phase one, and I'm going to be able to reopen my doors. What does my business need to look like? And what are the things that I need to consider? And that's what these guidelines are there for, to help a business understand what's the new normal for my business and how do I approach that.
Well, it seems like the key there is the mindset itself, that we won't end safer at home and then you just walk in and it's business the same it was at the end of February, right? That you're hoping in these guidelines that most, maybe all businesses are going to change the way they do things at least a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we need to set the expectations, right? If you're an employee who's coming back into a business, you should be able to expect that your employer has taken steps to do what we can to assure your safety. Now, you know, the challenge of COVID-19 is that it is, very spreadable and it moves invisibly. But you can expect that your business will have taken some steps to protect you. And as a consumer, you should also expect that the businesses that you're going to go shop at or eat at are thinking about your safety and thinking about, you know, how do we mitigate this risk of COVID-19? And then the employees and the consumers should be expecting behavior out of each other. So we really have to have kind of a new normal of what we expect and hold each other accountable for.
We're talking to Missy Hughes, CEO and Secretary of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. The agency has new safety guidelines for businesses in the state by some general guidelines and also individual by sector. Well, Secretary Hughes, let's look at, you know, a big facility. We've seen outbreaks in meatpacking plants, for example, in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. What kind of guidelines are in this document for, you know, a facility where people are manufacturing or processing things like that? They're in close quarters, whether it's essential or non-essential businesses, they reopen. What kind of things are in these guidelines for them?
Well, I think you're raising a really good point, Rob, that I want to call out, which is just because something has been deemed essential doesn't mean that it's safe. And that's why every business, whether you've been open the whole time or whether you're just being able to reopen, needs to be assessing what's happening on the factory floor, what's happening in the offices, and making sure that we're thinking about it from that perspective about what is safe. We don't offer on our website guidelines for a meatpacking plant. Obviously, you know, those are being analyzed by the CDC and thought about, you know, very carefully from that perspective because of the close quarters. But what we've been able to do because of our great manufacturing base in Wisconsin is go and have conversations with manufacturers that have seen this come across the whole globe, right? They have operations in China, France, Italy, and so they've been providing advice to us from a manufacturing perspective about what changes and what protocols need to be happening all the way through. And it's been really encouraging to understand, you know, the simple things that you can do, like stagger shifts, or think about pain points on the floor where employees are too close to each other and be able to make adjustments.
Now, for a lot of people, as customers, our experience will be in that retail setting you were talking about earlier. Can you talk a little more about guidelines for retail stores? Again, the ones that have been considered essential and are open right now, and the ones that are hoping to open their doors soon.
Yeah, so we have, as you pointed out, both general guidelines and then specific guidelines for each of these kind of types of industries. And so the general guidelines continue to be social distancing, hand washing, you know, face masks, and being thoughtful about those high touch surfaces and cleaning them often. And then when you go into a retail environment, you might be thinking about the checkout stand and thinking about putting up plexiglass for your employees and your customers. You think about the social distancing. So as you're waiting in line, you can be assured to have social distancing. And then around the store, thinking about those high touch areas, whether they are door handles or if folks are picking up and putting, you know, trying things on, how are you handling that? I've heard of some retail shops that are just going ahead and closing their fitting rooms so that they don't have to worry about, you know, the high touch in a fitting room. So there's just different ways to be thinking about this. And you know, because of the diversity of the Wisconsin economy, we're not going to be able to answer every question. But what we're really encouraging is for businesses to literally stand in your shop and look and think about, like, okay, you know, where do I need to be making adjustments here? Because every business is different, but there are these general guidelines, and then really being thoughtful about your own business that can help us all get the economy rolling again and regain that momentum that we need.
As we wrap up, where can our listeners, say if they own a business, go to find all this information?
Yeah, thank you. WEDC.org. You can find it from our front page, our the homepage, or you can go to WEDC.org/reopen-guidelines.
Secretary Hughes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Missy Hughes, head of the state's Economic Development Agency, WEDC. She was with us today to talk about the safety guidelines the Evers administration issued last week on how businesses can eventually reopen safely during the coronavirus outbreak. Coming up, we'll talk to Representative Mike Gallagher about a new military construction contract in Marinette. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the coronavirus pandemic is likely to impact November's presidential election, and absentee voting could be more in demand than ever. We'll talk about the debate about voting by mail and find out what other states are doing. Now, the U.S. Navy has chosen Wisconsin's Fincantieri Marinette Marine as the site to build a new fleet of warships. The deal would build the first 10 of those ships and is expected to create around 5,000 direct and indirect jobs in the area. Representative Mike Gallagher is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes Green Bay and Marinette. Representative Gallagher, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more about this deal and how Marinette was chosen to build these ships?
Well, winning the frigate competition was not just an economic win for Northeast Wisconsin or for Wisconsin in general, but really it's a win for all of American military power, for the free world, and a bad day for our enemies, because this ship that we're going to be building in Northeast Wisconsin will really serve as the foundation for the future fleet, which will be dominated by smaller, more adaptable surface combatants like the frigate, that will have that mission of doing deterrence, keeping the peace, particularly in the first island chain in the Indo-Pacific region. And so while this initial award is for 10 ships with a follow-on award of the next 10 up for a recompete, I think we're going to need to see a lot more, like above 20, probably north of 60 or 70 if you talk to naval experts that study this stuff for a living. And so really a testament to the hard workers at the shipyard in Marinette, and a really exciting day for Wisconsin.
Can you talk about the economic impact of this for Marinette and the surrounding area?
Well, in the immediate, the contract's going to be worth more than $5 billion, and by some accounts, create more than 5,000 jobs, both direct jobs at the shipyard and then indirect jobs. Think of all the subcomponent suppliers that build parts of the ship. Think of just the local retail businesses or food businesses that will benefit from an increased traffic in the shipyard. And so that's a huge win, but also just the long-term stability for the shipyard. The fact is that the littoral combat ship that we were building there prior was on its way out. And so this ship basically guarantees two decades of life at the shipyard. And that's two decades of Wisconsinites working hard to build the absolute best and most advanced ship in the U.S. Navy arsenal. That is something we should all be proud of.
What was the competition like around the country to win this contract?
Well, it was very stiff competition. We had, four other competitors. It got down to three real serious competitors at the end. And, I think part of the reason why Wisconsin won, beyond the fact that we had the best ship design and we have the best workers, is I do think there's a national security imperative to keeping all of our shipyards alive right now. The fact is, with the decline of commercial shipbuilding in the last five decades, we've seen a contraction in the overall number of shipyards. We're currently at seven shipyards. And it's really important from a health of the defense industrial base perspective to make sure that we have not only a few shipyards concentrated on the East Coast, but strong shipyards right here in the industrial Midwest. And so that's just an added benefit to us winning the competition. But it was very fierce. Right now, we're sort of waiting to see if one of the companies that lost it can test the bid. But I have confidence that we will prevail, even if there is a what's called a protest of the bid. And at the end of the day, it was hard work and the best design out there that allowed us to win.
We have had concerns from some listeners on social media about the priority of military spending in the first place, saying, hey, we've got, for example, the coronavirus pandemic absorbing a lot of money from the U.S. budget. What would you say to them about the priority for this project?
Well, I do think that the enormous amount of money we're having to spend on combating coronavirus will exert a downward pressure on the defense budget in the next few years. But that's all the more reason why we need to be building ships like this. This is a smaller ship. It costs half of what a destroyer costs. It can go places that destroyers can't go. And so a ship like this that's flexible gets us more defense at less cost. So I actually think if you are concerned about the growth of the defense budget or concerned about retaining a strong defense in a fiscally constrained environment, a frigate like this is the best option. Combine that with two things, autonomous ships being one, and INF non-compliant missiles. That's intermediate range missiles, which we weren't allowed to develop before. And I think we can actually achieve what we want to achieve vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party and the PLA Navy without having to bankrupt ourselves any further. And the final thing I'd say is, as we all know, it's not defense that's driving our long-term debt. It's mandatory spending. And the cost of having to mobilize for war, just like the cost of having to mobilize in the wake of an unexpected pandemic, are always more than the cost of investing on the front end to keep the peace.
What is the timeline for constructing these frigates and rolling, or I guess floating them out?
Well, we're going to be, I mean, in many ways, beginning work immediately. They're going to have to start hiring more engineers. I believe the first ship is scheduled to be delivered in the mid-2020s, but work is really going to be delivered immediately. And then whether we ramp up based on initial success will depend on how they award, you know, future ships within this class. And so, you know, we're going to be having to do everything possible to recruit not only engineers, but, you know, welders, workers. I mean, these are really good paying jobs. They represent, you know, almost the best of Wisconsin manufacturing. And so it's really an exciting time, not only to be in the shipyard, but just to be in Northeast Wisconsin.
We're talking to Wisconsin Congressional Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican in the 8th District, talking so far about this frigate contract going to a company in Marinette. Representative Gallagher wanted to talk to you about some COVID-related news. You recently worked on securing a donation of surgical masks that are coming here to Wisconsin. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd seen about 3 weeks ago that Taiwan had donated masks to our neighboring state, Illinois. And I thought, you know, maybe it's just the Packers fan in me. I get a little competitive whenever I see something from Illinois. But I called my friends in Taiwan up and I said, if you're considering future donations, please consider Wisconsin. And they said, well, Wisconsin wasn't initially on our list because, you know, we're not as populous of a state, but we'd be glad to consider it. And then the next day I got a call saying, how many do you need and where should we deliver them? And I think it's just a testament to the importance of having strong allies like Taiwan. And the fact is that Taiwan's success, not only in combating coronavirus, but broader economic and political success stands in stark contrast to the failure of the Chinese Communist Party. Its very existence repudiates the existence of the Chinese Communist Party. And so I think we need to be finding ways to stand even stronger with Taiwan, because Taiwan has come to the aid of Wisconsin at a very difficult time.
And we've seen a few rounds of economic recovery efforts from Congress and the president over the last couple of months. One of the big conversations right now is, do we need part four? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly think we're going to be needing to replenish the Paycheck Protection Program and the small business loans that we're giving out, as well as fix some administrative errors in that program. Where I get worried is when I hear reports of Nancy Pelosi potentially including bailouts for states, unlike Wisconsin, that haven't been as responsible. We have perhaps the healthiest pension plan in the United States overall. And if we're going to be paying money to bail out states that haven't been as responsible as us, I think that's really unfair. And so I really hope it doesn't go in that direction and we can stay focused on providing support to the small businesses and people on the front lines that need it. But in order to do that, in order to have a productive debate, Congress needs to be in session. And the fact is that we just got an email earlier today saying we're unlikely to be in session again this week till at least Friday. I think that's unconscionable. I think Congress needs to reconvene. It's long past time. We should have done it weeks ago. And so I really urge the speaker to get Congress back to work, and we can lead by example, because we're going to have to be asking a lot of Wisconsinites and people around the country to start responsibly getting back to work soon.
Now, we've seen with the Senate coming back into session, a bunch of health safety precautions going on. There's a lot more of you in the House than in the Senate. Do you see some things that you could do on the floor to keep everybody safe there?
Well, in the last vote we had a couple weeks ago, we did take enhanced safety measures. They had a scheduled time for different groups of members to vote, so we weren't all congregating on the House floor. There was a supply of hand sanitizer and masks on the House floor. I think that's a very common sense measure. And I do think within the committee rooms, obviously, we're not going to be opening up the Capitol to visitors, so we'll have more space to conduct committee work. And then, you know, we as individual offices, I think, can continue to allow our staffs to telework, to work from home. My staff, both in D.C. and here in Wisconsin, has been working the whole time and doing, you know, creative ways to do constituent services, but doing it from home. And so we can do things like that to mitigate the risk. And if the Senate's doing it, I think we can do it in the House.
I was hoping to get your thoughts on the pace of reopening, another big debate now. We have a lot of states trying to follow federal benchmarks a step at a time to reopen things, but then some criticism at the local level, sometimes at the federal level, for the pace of reopening. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it has to transition to a bottom-up process. Really, I mean, different regions of the state are going to have different needs. There are very rural areas where they can start to open up immediately and almost go back to normal. There are more populous areas, Madison and Milwaukee, and even Green Bay, where we'll probably have to move slower than, say, a Brilliant or a Manawa or a Sturgeon Bay. I think it's that bottom-up approach with a healthy dose of humility that will allow us to open up and understand that as we open up, there will be spread. I mean, the spread is inevitable. It's just a question of how do we slow the spread without overwhelming the healthcare system. But I think in even the most aggressive timeline for reopening, we have to think very hard about how can we protect the most vulnerable population, particularly those who we know are in nursing homes. We know that is a particularly at-risk environment with a particularly at-risk population. And so even in the most aggressive timeline, we should still be finding ways to responsibly protect those in nursing homes.
Representative Gallagher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Representative Mike Gallagher is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes Green Bay and Marinette. He joins us today for a look at a new U.S. Navy contract for a shipbuilding company based in Marinette. Also, a donation of masks from Taiwan to Wisconsin and other issues in COVID-19 response. Coming up, absentee voting is likely to play a big role in the November election. We'll find out how other states handle voting by mail and why it's become such a hot political debate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, labs around the world are rushing to come up with a vaccine to the novel coronavirus, but these things take time. A vaccine expert tells us about the challenges facing those researchers and what the unique nature of this virus means for the hunt for a vaccine. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin is more than a month out from our April election. The state's election day amid the pandemic made national headlines, with many people scrambling to cast their ballots by mail. And tomorrow, voters in northern Wisconsin will go to the polls to vote for their next representative in a special congressional election. Now, with medical experts warning of a second wave of the novel coronavirus this fall, voting by mail, also known as absentee voting, is becoming a nationwide debate. Voting rights groups and many Democrats want to see more people have the ability to vote by mail, but Republicans and the president are resisting that push. Several states have had success with universal vote-by-mail systems. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. She's also author of the book Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. She recently wrote about the growing attention being paid to absentee voting. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, looking ahead to November, we've got an election, of course, a big one, and the risk of this second wave. What kind of questions are people asking about what this November election is going to look like?
Well, one thing that's important about a big national election is you have to plan for it in advance. And so the people who are thinking ahead prudently are imagining a world in which people are still worried about going to the polls in the same numbers that they have in the past because of the threat of the pandemic. And according to a survey that the Pew Research Center did recently, about 2/3 of Americans think that it's very possible that the virus will disrupt the normal election process. So then you have a move by some states to try to increase the number of people voting by mail. And this is, you know, an obvious tactic to try because it means that people are voting from home, which would be safer if the pandemic is still with us. And secondarily, you have a conversation about trying to make the polls as safe as possible by having more early voting, which would reduce crowding, and then also having the kind of protective equipment and disinfecting and social distancing that we've gotten used to from the rest of our lives.
Let's get into mail-in voting. You cover this a lot in this big piece you wrote on elections in the U.S. during the pandemic. It's easy for me to say, let's vote by mail. Let's have everybody or a lot more people vote by mail. But in your piece, you talk about the logistical challenges. A lot of things have to happen before we exponentially increase the number of people who vote by mail in this country. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, Wisconsin has more experience with this kind of dramatic increase than any state, because in your primary in April, in your election, what happened was that the state went from previously about 3% of people requesting absentee ballots to more than 70%. And that just puts a huge strain on the whole system, right? It means that basically election officials have to create and increase the volume of a new system for voting. So there are supply chain issues, like the same ones we've had with creating enough ventilators or producing enough tests, this issue the country's still struggling with. Well, if you talk to the vendors who produce ballots and envelopes, all of that process, you need to have machinery in place for it to really, really ramp up production. And you need time to plan. So I was talking to someone who runs a bulk mail business, and he was pointing out that if he was going to get a new machine that would fold the ballots and put them into the envelopes, he would need to spend $1 million. And he would need to order that machine pretty much now or in the next few weeks in order to have it in line in time to print those ballots. Well, he's not going to spend money on that machine unless he has orders coming in from cities and states across the country. And yet a lot of those places are worried about paying for this increase in vote by mail because Congress has only so far appropriated a small fraction of the money that people think it's going to cost.
That brings up another big point. However, local and state governments respond to this, whether it's more voting by mail or more safety at the polling places, that costs money, and these same governments are already strained by declining tax revenue. Can you talk about the financial crunch facing state and local governments trying to ramp up their elections?
Yeah, I mean, state and local governments have been under such financial pressure across the country. They are facing this huge decline in tax revenues because of all the curtailments on business right at the moment when they're also on the hook for paying for more things. The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University estimates that the cost of truly preparing for this election in the pandemic or with the threat of the pandemic is about $4 billion across the country. That includes all the primary elections still to come this summer and the cost mostly of November. So far, Congress has only pledged $400 million. So $400 million out of $4 billion, that's not very much. And there's a big push by hundreds of civil rights groups and public interest groups to get that money flowing, but that has not happened yet.
We are talking about voting in the United States during a pandemic. Emily Bazelon is with us from New York Times Magazine. She wrote a big piece on issues related to voting and the ongoing illness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. By the way, what, if any, kind of changes would you like to see between now and, say, November Election Day? More voting by mail options? Did you try to vote by mail, had trouble doing it last time around? Call 800-642-1234. Emily, we've touched on a couple of the obstacles to voting by mail, the logistics, the cost. There's also political pushback. What is going on with the debate over whether we should want to expand vote by mail?
You know, this is sort of strange. It's become very polarized, with Democrats asking for Congress to fund this election at a greater level and talking about the importance of access to the ballot, and federal Republicans in Washington opposing that request. there are certainly Republican state officials, including the folks who run elections in states like Iowa and Ohio and New Hampshire, who are asking for this money and saying we want as many people to vote as possible. But the Republican Party in Washington has taken a stance against it. And there was this telling moment about a month ago where President Trump said that the Democrats' request would bring up levels of voting to a point that Republicans wouldn't be able to win. Now, that's called saying the quiet part out loud, because usually people who oppose expanding the franchise, expanding voting, say, well, it's going to promote fraud. There is a fear, however, among some Republicans that simply increasing or allowing for turnout is bad for them, like that they will lose elections if more people vote. The funny thing is that the social science does not match up with that conclusion. In states that have switched to universal voting by mail, there has been no partisan effect. It has not helped Republicans. It has not helped Democrats. It has modestly boosted turnout.
I want to give a listen to President Trump raising another concern. He has called expanding absentee voting corrupt. The day after Wisconsin's April primary, here's what he had to say about it.
And if you send something in, you should be sure, as a state and as a country, you should be sure that that vote is meaningful and it's not just made fraudulently, because there's a lot of fraudulent voting going on in this country.
Now, what do we know about fraudulent voting, especially when it comes to voting by mail?
The idea that voter fraud in America is widespread is a myth. It's just simply not true, especially for in-person voting. Now, absentee balloting, there have been problems in the past in certain parts of the country, particularly the Southeast or some big cities like Philadelphia or Miami. It's not common. It has happened on occasion. What's interesting is that the states that have the strongest histories of voting by mail, where the most people do it, they don't have a problem with voter fraud. They have figured out how to do this securely.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about states that are currently voting by mail, I think exclusively. Can you tell us who's doing that and how it's working?
Yeah, there are five states that have what we call universal vote by mail. So those states are Utah, which leans Republican, some states that lean Democratic, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington, and then Colorado, which has commonly elected statewide officials from both parties. So you see there the lack of a partisan effect. What universal vote by mail means is that every registered voter receives a ballot in the mail. They don't have to return it via the post office. Like, they can do that. They can put a stamp on it, or sometimes the states will pay for the return postage. There also are secure drop-off boxes around town where you can put your ballot. And then the third option is to return it to an in-person polling site, because all these states keep some polling centers open. Those are for people who don't have a stable mailing address. And we may have more of those people in November if the economic downturn continues and there's more mobility as a result of it. And then there are also people with certain disabilities like blindness who need assistance at a polling site to vote.
You mentioned the U.S. Postal Service, and that's another wrinkle you throw into your piece, uncertainty about its future, really.
Yeah, so the Postal Service is warning that it could run out of money at the end of September. It needs funding from Congress. This has unfortunately become another polarized issue where Democrats are saying, yes, let's fund the post office, and Republicans are balking. In a way, that seems odd again, because the post office is particularly important in rural communities. The reason the post office is having financial problems, there are two reasons. One is it's another fallout effect from the virus, because first-class mail and package delivery is down by 30%. So even though people are relying a lot on home delivery, that is not making up for the shortfall. And the second reason is this weird burden imposed on the post office, which is that it was given in 2006, Congress said, the post office has to fund its pension plan 75 years out into the future, fully fund it. This is not something that any government agency has to do. Like the Pentagon, it's pay as you go. That's true for other parts of the federal government. If the post office didn't have this 75-year pension burden, it would actually not be in the red. So that's an extra kind of yoke around the neck of the Postal Service.
We're talking to Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, about the role absentee voting could play in the November elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Wisconsin and other states expand the ability to vote by mail? Should all voters have access to an absentee ballot if they want it? Should they be automatically mailed to all voters? Do you have potential problems or concerns you see with that system? And are you worried about the presidential election being impacted by coronavirus and a possible second wave in the fall? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about absentee voting around the country and the role it could play in November with Emily Bazelon from the New York Times Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin should do more to give people the chance to vote by mail? What challenges do you see coming along with that? Do you think it's going to be important in the November elections? If you work in local elections as a clerk or a poll worker, love to hear from you, your reactions to last month's election in the state, what you hope for, what you fear come November. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hello.
Yeah, hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Jerry?
I want to tell you what I think and what most of the normal American citizens think about vote by mail. Vote by mail is for people that are disabled in a wheelchair, and that's probably 1% or 2% of the entire population. Vote by mail is for people that don't want to go to the polls because they want to vote three times. Vote by mail, if it's ever approved, that'll require a hand count and a hand verification of every vote that comes in. The mail carriers can't be trusted. That's already been proven. So it'll have to be done a different way, maybe by the FBI or the CIA, and pick up the large cloth bags with the...
Jerry, I got you. You gave us a lot to work with already there. First of all, Jerry's saying this should be just for people with a disability who can't vote. And in many cases, that's, Emily, been how absentee is, vote by mail has been used, right?
Well, it's true that there are a bunch of states where in the past, the rate of absentee balloting has been below 10%, not just for people with disabilities, people who are traveling, elderly people use it at a higher rate. It's also true that across the whole country in 2018, the rate of voting by mail was 25%. So we already have a significant number of people doing this. We just don't have most people doing it.
And Jerry raising the concern of people voting multiple times with absentee ballots. What do we know about that?
I mean, like I said before, there have been instances of absentee ballot fraud. The best known example was in a race for Congress in North Carolina in 2018, where a Republican candidate hired someone who went around and picked up ballots and maybe filled them in when they weren't, or maybe even threw some of them away. So it is possible. And one of the ways that states can prevent that from happening is having a limit on the number of ballots that anyone can turn in for someone else. So some states have laws like only someone in your family can turn in your ballot. Some states say someone can only pick up 10 ballots that don't belong to them. The rate of fraud in states like Colorado and Washington that have been doing this for about a decade is very, very low. That's what all the officials there say. So I think that kind of mistrust is pretty misplaced.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. We also heard from Patsy on Facebook who said, I'm all for mail-in voting. My daughter lives in Oregon, the state, not Oregon, the Wisconsin community, and they do it all the time. Emily, a couple different perspectives on there on what the public thinks about mail-in voting. Do we have, I don't know, is there polling or a sense of what people across America think about the idea of more mail-in voting?
You know, I think it's one of those things where once you get used to it, it just becomes normal. And like your caller's daughter, I think she said, like people get used to it and most people like it because it's super convenient, right? I mean, I was thinking about this myself. I live in Connecticut. You have to have an excuse to get an absentee ballot. I did it once. It was kind of a pain. But this year, the Secretary of State, because of the virus, is going to send every registered voter an application for an absentee ballot. And once I get it, it'll take me 5 minutes to deal with it, as opposed to going and standing in line at our polling place, which, you know, I kind of like doing that. It's my moment of Democratic participation. But in a general election, it can take like an hour or more to stand in line. I'm not eager to go stand in a long line if the pandemic is still a threat. And I think a lot of Americans feel that way.
We're talking to Emily Bazelon with New York Times Magazine, looking at voting in the United States during the pandemic, efforts to expand voting by mail. Back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hello. My issue has to do with receiving absentee ballots at a post office box, which are not cheap, but I do pay for my own security, because mailboxes, contrary to what most people seem to assume, are not really secure. People can put their hands right into your metal box on the side of your house and take out whatever they please. Therefore, I have duct tape around my mailbox so that nothing can be put in there. And I would want to receive my ballot for sure at my post office box. Is this possible?
Lisa, thanks for the call. I know this has been an issue, how voting by mail systems handle with PO boxes. Is that something you've looked at, Emily?
You know, that is a great question, and I don't know what the answer is in Wisconsin. I think in some states you can receive a ballot through the post office, but I'm not sure about Wisconsin, and I don't want to give a wrong answer, so I'm just going to leave that one for someone more expert than me.
Well, I'm not more expert, but we'll try to figure that out, Lisa. I don't have an answer for you right now either, but thank you for calling in. I will go to Jeff now on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, Rob. So this is a great debate. I think it's important for our society to have this debate. And I foresee 5-10 years from now where we're all going to get a national ID when we're born, like a Social Security number. And that ID would allow us to get a passport. Doesn't matter where you live in the United States. But then you are considered a national citizen, natural born citizen. And that opens doors because you are what your number is or whatever. And then if you have a national ID, doesn't matter how you get your ballot, because you can vote using your national ID wherever you live, and then it would be simple. I think we need to simplify this.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We don't have that system in place now, Emily, but how have the mail-in, universal mail-in states handled credentials, making sure voters are who they say they are and eligible to vote when they mail in a ballot?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're right. We don't have a national ID, for better or worse. And so what happens instead is that you have to register to vote. That usually means, you know, providing some state approved identification when you register, and usually like a piece of mail so that it's clear that you live at your address. The vote by mail states try really hard to keep their lists up to date, because it becomes really important to have current addresses for everybody. You can't just like rely on the poll worker to sort it out if you've moved. And so you have those lists, and then when people vote, they have to sign the ballot. They often also have to sign the outside of the envelope across the place where it seals. And that's another way of preventing fraud. And then the signatures are verified. And an earlier caller mentioned that someone has to look at all the ballots. In some states, it's true. Human beings do all that review to verify signatures. In other states, a machine does it. Wisconsin, I learned when I was reporting this story, actually doesn't have signature verification. You have a witness who signs the back of the envelope. And that's how you verify identity in your state.
And there's concern if we're socially isolating ourselves, some people not wanting to expose themselves to risk by bringing a witness in. Emily, we just have a few moments left. Do you get a sense that states are scrambling at this point to try to get ahead in November?
Yeah, I mean, from my reporting, this is really possible, right? Like, we can do this. South Korea just had a very successful election with the highest turnout in decades in the middle of the pandemic. America is perfectly capable of surmounting this logistical challenge, but we have to prepare and get on it. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in the same kind of late behind the eight ball position that we've been in responding to the pandemic in general. So I think this is very possible, but it's about thinking ahead and planning and being prepared.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at New York Times Magazine. She talked to us about the push for increased absentee voting for the November election, which medical experts warn could be happening during a second wave of COVID-19. You can still let us know what you think about Wisconsin and other states expanding vote by mail. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.